The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good afternoon. You are joining We the People Radio with Aaron Ryan. Oh, Bill Kundefu has no sound.
Uh-oh, am I alive?
You're playing musical chairs with the microphones again.
Oh, well,
Bill's fired.
I knew this wasn't my mic, but they said use it.
You look like you're on mic three, but you're actually on mic four there. Okay.
It's like Joe Dirt.
This is like Got mic one, mic two.
That's exactly where I was going. Sad is that. We usually have some sort of a pitfall.
Yeah, step up to the mic.
And the person who's in charge of us that we blame for all of this is Bob Martin, our engineer. But since my mom's also in the studio, I guess we could blame her today. And she says, you're not going to make me say anything, so you don't have to. She just nodded her head. That's it.
That's it.
Easy as it comes. Okay, so we're going to get right to it because we only have an hour with Mr. McQuillan today, and we don't want to cheat anybody out of this because it's a huge topic. So,
yeah, how many folks out there have state or federal or local pensions that are totally safe, never going to get chopped into?
No, or they're, you know, taxpayers, in which case they're paying for them. So, you know, it's in everyone's vested interest that we get this thing handled. And I think unless you're in denial, you know, there's some kind of a problem out there. So we've got an expert for you. He has written a book called California Dreaming. Subtitle is Lessons on How to Resolve America's Public Pension Crisis. And Lawrence McQuillan is a senior fellow and director of the Center on Entrepreneurial Innovation at the Independent Institute. Their website is independent.org. Really easy. He's frequently a guest on all sorts of big programs, Fox Business, CNN, C-SPAN, NPR, and is written up in the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Chronicle, Chicago Tribune, all over the place.
Yeah, busy man.
So the important part is, because we're sending this program to our friends in Philadelphia, the book is entitled California Dreaming, but he obviously goes into what's happening across the country and in many, many other states. They're being affected as well. All right, so that's the end of my knowledge, and the rest of the show is now all about Lawrence McQuillan. Are you in there, Lawrence?
No. Hi, Ian. Hi, Bill.
There we go.
Hello, Lawrence. Thanks for being with us today.
Okay. Thanks. It's great to be with you.
All right. So, huge topic, and you can take it wherever you'd like to go. We're not really sure how this all started, so I guess maybe how did we get into this mess?
It is a mess. It's right now it's about a $4.7 trillion deficit. That's with a T, across the country. I mean, some states are in worse condition than others. Illinois, New York, Texas, Ohio, New Jersey are in really bad situation. But the worst of them all is California, which has right now a $750 billion unfunded pension debt. It's a huge problem, and now politicians are scrambling to come up with the money to fund it. Keep in mind, I mean, this is $750 billion unfunded pension debt, and this is money that should be in the bank today to pay for the promises that have been made and the pensions that have been earned, but the money's not there. And now politicians are scrambling to come up with the money to pay for this problem.
Well, I'm a little confused, Lawrence, because I just heard Jerry Brown the other day said California now, because of the big tech explosion, we have a big surplus now. So he's going to implement new things, spend more money. So what about that surplus?
Yeah, well, that's the problem. They've been spending the surplus on other things rather than putting it into the pension plan. And that's kind of how we got into this problem. For decades, politicians have increase the pension benefits in California, but also for decades they failed to put the money in on a regular basis into the pension plans to fully fund them. And instead they spent the money on other things. And so that's how we got into the mess we're in today in California. And the story is very similar across the country. I mean, the same problem occurred in Illinois, in New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Texas, that are facing similar huge deficits like this. Politicians have mismanaged these pension plans. They've spent the money on other things rather than putting it into the pension fund. But at the same time, they increased benefits because, let's face it, I mean, people like higher pensions when they retire, and it was an easy way for them to buy votes and campaign contributions.
Was this one of the major reasons Detroit went down the tubes?
It was, absolutely, yep. Detroit's obviously the biggest bankruptcy due to unaffordable pension costs, but other cities, of course, in California went bankrupt over the same thing. Vallejo, Stockton, San Bernardino have all gone bankrupt over unaffordable pension costs. But, yeah, the granddaddy of them all was Detroit, which didn't have the money to pay for its pensions and other services. I mean, in fact, they were turning off streetlights. I mean, that's how bad it got in Detroit. And ultimately, the federal bankruptcy judge there in Detroit ruled that the city could reduce pension checks for current retirees, so they could actually reduce the checks that are paying former government employees in Detroit. And people there, you know, assumed that these were sacrosanct, they could never be reduced, but here we were facing that situation where they were being reduced because the money just wasn't there, and they weren't putting in the money responsibly year after year in the pension plan.
So if you're a current, say you're a current retired California state employee and you're, you know, kicking back, living on your pension, that may not be necessarily
written in
safe.
Stone.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think most government employees today or, you know, retired government employees assume that money's going to be there, are counting on that money being there. And yet, as has been shown in Detroit, it's not absolutely assured. The money could not be there, and then the checks will have to be reduced. But as I mentioned, Stockton also went bankrupt, and the federal bankruptcy judge there ruled that Stockton could also reduce pension benefits for current retirees if they chose. It ended up that Stockton chose not to go that route, but again, they were given that option if they wanted to reduce pension checks for current retirees. So, yeah, I think government employees in California need to realize that these pension checks aren't necessarily guaranteed anymore, and it's really important, therefore, then to make sure that the money is there and to take the steps that are going to be necessary to fully fund these pensions that have already been earned.
How does, you know, this is kind of it's a shifting system because they withdraw, they hold some money from the worker during their time of their employment. And then
right.
The entity, whatever it's city, county, state, they pay into it, but it has a lot to do with how the investment market is going.
Right, yeah. How the defined benefit pensions work is that the government employer and typically the government employee contribute a certain percentage of salary every pay period or monthly into the pension fund. And then the pension fund invests that money. And the plan is that ultimately 20, 30, 40 years down the line when the employees retire, the investments would have grown to the amount necessary to pay for the pension benefits. But yeah, that's one of the problems was volatility in the stock market. I mean, not just in 2008, but also, you know, the dot-com bubble and things like that. And pension funds in California were really too heavily invested in equities and real estate, and their portfolios were really susceptible to high-risk changes in volatility and returns. And so that's one of the problems. But if you look at California, that these pension funds were really trending downward way before the Great Recession. So I know the pension funds like to kind of blame this problem on the 2008 recession, but since the late 1990s, the pension funds have been trending towards an unhealthy position, primarily because, as I mentioned, the benefits just kept being raised. In fact, in 1999, not only were benefits raised, but the raise was made retroactive. So very irresponsible management of these funds. And so now we're in the position we are today with this massive $750 billion deficit.
Lawrence, what, you know, we hear all the time that, you know, like Social Security, they're saying now that there's more people drawing Social Security than are actually paying in, and so it's just going to run out of money. In California, on this pension situation, do you know what the ratio is of workers that are currently paying into the program versus the amount of people that are drawing it out? I mean, is that a number we need to worry about, or is it strictly the return on investment that's killing the fund?
Well, it's more so the increase in the benefits relative to what's been contributed. I mean, for decades they've been lowballing the contributions the politicians have, so that in effect then it would free up money that they could use for other programs. So that's really the big problem, is that the work just consistently wasn't managed financially responsibly over the years. But yeah, there is an imbalance. I mean, soon I think there's going to be more government retirees and people paying into the funds, which is, you know, that wouldn't be a problem, though, if they had fund this, you know, consistently over time, which is what you want to do. I mean, ideally what you want to have is about 110% of obligations in the bank, so that you always kind of have a cushion there in
sure.
case the markets fluctuate. But nationally, these pension funds are less than 40% funded. In California, I mean, they're less than, in some cases, less than 20% funded. So they're really in a precarious situation. You know, there's, from the politician's point of view now, they're scrambling to come up with the money, and they've been doing a couple things. One, which is reducing services. So essentially what they've been doing is taking money from core government services like police and fire and schools and libraries and taking that money and putting it into the pension plan. So that's one approach. And the other approach has been obviously just to increase taxes and take in more money and put it into the pension plan. But the bottom line is, I mean, that means more resources going to pay for pensions and less resources to go for, you know, core government services that people count on, especially in a blue state like California, where most people like their government services and, you know, they don't like seeing money diverted from core things that they expect to be there, like, you know, filling in potholes and maintaining the roads.
Right. We have to take a really quick break, but when we come back, one of our guests in the chat room has asked, with CalPERS invested in bonds, if the Greek, you know, situation takes off and bonds crash, does that explode the unfunded amount? Is that kind of the balance point that you're describing?
Yeah, I mean, it definitely won't help. I don't know how heavily, you know, involved they are in European bonds or Greek bonds, but I think that kind of contagion could spread, and it certainly wouldn't help. I mean, they're at such a huge deficit at this point, though, that, you know, they're in big problems no matter how the markets perform, and there's no way they're going to invest their way out of this. We need radical structural reform of the public pension plans in California. A little bit of more earnings here or there is not going to fix this problem.
Well, that's good to know, because I know that when the markets were performing really well, I know, like, different cities and counties were putting less in, so they felt like they could increase the benefits because their contribution was low at that time, and they kind of didn't
right.
factor in, gee, if the market goes down the tube, you know, their percentage is going to go way up, and they might not be able to handle that. We're going to come right back with Lawrence McQuillan. We're discussing the public pension crisis. I really like your subtitle, Lawrence, Lessons on How to Resolve America's Public Pension Crisis, because it isn't just a city, a county, or a state, and you've got some really good ideas on how to fix it. So we're not just going to talk about how bad it is. We'll talk a little bit about how to fix it when we come back. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Or maybe we'll just keep talking. Oh, no, here we go. We'll be right back.
Then they go, what shall we do?
Nice theme, Bob.
That's our state capital taking the money and running.
That's what's happening in a lot of states.
Yeah.
And so there are guys in Philadelphia that will be listening to this Tuesday. It's happening in their state, too. It's everywhere. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us, and you can always hear the archive or catch the rest of the information, especially about the book, California Dreaming, Lessons on How to Resolve America's Public Pension Crisis. Our guest today is Lawrence McQuillan. All right, Bill's got a burning question.
I got a burning question, but we had somebody in the chat room brought up a great point.
Those guys.
Now they're trying to tax the CalPERS energy portfolio for its carbon footprint here in California. So, you know.
They're talking about divesting out of all fossil fuels, which is going to make their portfolio worth less than it was before.
Yeah, anytime there's money in a fund somewhere, they're going to try to get their hands on it for whatever reason. My question, Lawrence, is, you know, we're going to talk about some solutions here. I know locally new employees, new hirees, aren't given the same benefit package that past employees have had because of the unfunded portion. Is that something that California has implemented or has considered implementing on new employees, or are they just going straight along with the program and everybody gets the whole basket?
Yeah, that is something. In 2012, the state legislature passed a bill that put new hires after a certain date into a lower tier, a tier with reduced pension benefits. The problem with that, though, is fixing the pension system is kind of like trying to turn a blimp. Like you turn the wheel, and then about 6 miles later, you know, the blimp starts to move.
Right.
Because it's such a tsunami. I mean, it builds over time. Like the people that are in the system today that are working their way towards retirement and will retire soon, you know, these were people that were hired under the old plans, under the more generous plans. So you still have to pay those benefits. So anything that you do today for new hires, really, you're not going to see the advantages of that for 20, 30, 40 years in some cases. I mean, you'll have a little bit of a reduced current obligation, but still, the big bang in terms of the savings comes long down the road. So this accumulated debt that we have today, it doesn't really do anything about that, the changes that have been made. I mean, that's still an obligation of the state or the cities or the counties. They're going to have to come up with that money unless they want to walk away from those promises through bankruptcy or something like that. Otherwise, this debt is there. These benefits have been earned. The people have already done the work. And so now we're scrambling somehow to come up with the money to pay for that. And in the book, I have certain recommendations that will at least allow it to be done in a way that makes sense and is guaranteed, ultimately, to pay off this deficit.
I know at one time CalPERS was the largest investment or pension investment fund on the planet. Is that still the case, or is this unfunded thing?
It's the largest in the U.S.
Oh, in the U.S.?
It's the largest in the U.S., and in CalSTRS, the pension plan for teachers in California, that's the second largest. So we have the largest and the second largest in the United States right here in California.
And they're both sucking wind?
Yes, very much so. Yeah, they're both in terrible financial shape. And one point that was made before the break that is very important is that you mentioned that, you know, when good times are here, you know, the kind of happy days are here again. The returns are going to save us. That's what the pension plans always say. The problem with that, though, is when happy days are here again and the returns are booming, that's when the politicians increase the benefits again.
You know,
we saw this during the dot-com bubble when returns were high. That's when they passed the largest pension benefit increase in the history of California. And not only did that, but they made it retroactive, which really busted the bank on these pension plans. So even good investment periods don't save us, because that's when the politicians act the most irresponsibly and increase the benefits.
Yeah, not helpful. How is it supposed to work? Like, in a perfect world, if you were going to start a pension plan now, what would you do? Like, if the city had
no
obligations?
What I would do is copy what private companies have done decades ago, which is to transition out of these old-fashioned defined benefit pensions that guarantee a specific payment every month to retirees into a 401k plan. The state of Michigan has done it. The state of Alaska has done it. So this is not like pie in the sky. I mean, this is, these two states made this transition years ago. So it can be done. And so what I am proposing in the book is a defined contribution or a 401k plan, it's usually called, where the employer would make a certain percentage of your pay every pay period. They would deposit a percentage into a retirement account that would be controlled by the worker. It would be under their name. It would be portable. If they switch jobs, they would take the money. I mean, the money's theirs to keep. They could give it to their heirs. So it's a much more flexible, transparent, fiscally responsible system. And I show in the book that if we move to a 401k at the state level in California, a 10% contribution, which is really generous. I mean, most private companies provide like a 2 to 4% contribution. That's two to 4% of the employee's salary is contributed into a 401k plan. But I'm proposing a 10%. Even with a 10% 401k plan, the state of California would save more than $6 billion a year. Then they could take that savings and plow it back into the old defined benefit plans and pay that off. So by switching to a 401k, you actually generate the savings that you need to pay off this accumulated debt and do it in a way that wouldn't necessitate further cuts in public services or tax increases.
So I'm just guessing the union's not fired up about that idea.
No, they're
just
not.
Just taking a stab at it.
Right, yeah, but who is fired up, though, is a lot of voters in California, because 85%, according to the most recent survey, 85% of likely voters in California think that pension costs are either a problem or a big problem. So I think the public is way ahead of the legislators on this issue. I mean, I think they understand that this is a big cost, that there's no easy way out of this, and that we have to do something substantial to, bail ourselves out of this without, further tax increases or service cuts. So I think the public would be open to a transition to a 401k here in California.
I know, Lawrence, you don't have a crystal ball, but at the current rate, what do you see in the future? I mean, is this something that's going to possibly collapse rather quickly, or are we looking 10, 20 years down the road?
The slow strangulation?
Yeah.
Right. Well, I think it depends on where you live. For example, former mayor of Los Angeles, Richard Reardon, predicted that Los Angeles will go bankrupt over its pension costs in the next couple of years.
Oh.
And that would be, that would be devastating. That would be huge. That would be bigger than Detroit. In terms of the ramifications, I think. So I think it depends. And, of course, we've already seen Vallejo, Stockton, San Bernardino. I think there's other cities and counties in California that are teetering on the brink. It turns out that when about 20% of your revenues go to just retirement costs or above, which many cities are right there at that level, that's when cities tend to go bankrupt or they consider serious pension reform. And so I think, we're really on the brink here. And across the country, of course, Chicago is in a terrible situation. I mean, they have $30 billion of unfunded pension costs just for the city of Chicago alone.
Wow.
I think this is why everybody in America needs to be alert to this problem, because I could see a congressman in Washington, D.C. proposing a federal bankrupt or a federal bailout of the state and local pension funds across the country. I mean, Rahm Emanuel, he's a good friend of President Obama, and I could see him. I'd be shocked, actually, if he hasn't already approached the president and said, we need more federal money to solve this problem. And I think we're going to see more cities and counties across the country start to petition Washington, D.C. to step in to fix this. And that's the last thing we need. Is another bailout. I mean, people in Maine, I know, don't want to pay for the pension costs in California. And they're, you know, the country doesn't need another wholesale bailout of a fiscal or financial crisis.
Well, so I think what they don't ever fix it. They just keep doing it.
Well, they're just going to print more money, flood the market with more money, and it's going to be a huge...
That's their solution, will be exactly print more money and spend it on bailing out these state and local plans.
And then watch inflation take off.
I think, what's really needed is to do what I recommended earlier, you know, the structural change, this movement away from the old plans to the new. Most big corporations have done this decades ago. Most private companies of all sizes have done this years ago, because these big, defined benefit plans just are not sustainable, and they're so easy to financially mismanage.
Well, when you talk about bailouts, you know, if you're talking, you know, in relationship to how much money's out there, a small bailout, you're not going to really feel the effects of that. But if they bail out a national bailout of everybody's pension
plans...
Think
of how many pension plans are underwater, though.
Oh, we're going to be looking at what happened in Germany. I mean, we're going to run around with wheelbarrows full of money and for a loaf of bread.
Right, yeah. Well, nationally, it's $4.7 trillion of unfunded public pension debt. Can you imagine a bailout of that size with more printed money to do that? I mean, you're looking at hyperinflation eventually.
My wallet just had a heart attack.
I mean, this is why it's so critical, I think, to make this change that I'm recommending, because it would be a way of not only solving the problem today, but also creating the savings that you need long term to pay off this debt that's already been accumulated, and do it in a financially responsible way. I mean, it's not going to happen overnight, even with my plan. I mean, it's going to take 20 or 30 years, but at least you set up, I mean, just like any kind of bond, set up a repayment schedule. You'd make regular payments using the savings that you create from the transition to the 401k and pay off this debt in a reasonable amount of time.
Yeah, you gotta stop the bleeding first and then start turning the ship. But we're not
right,
even stopping
absolutely.
The bleeding.
I'm curious to know a kind of a scenario, like, because I know people look at the defined, what is it, defined pension or whatever it is. They know what they're...
defined benefit?
Yeah, defined benefit. They know what they're going to get when they retire. With 401k, that would be different. So how about, let's take a really quick break, and when we come back, maybe paint us a scenario on both sides, because otherwise it's really easy to dismiss. A lot of people don't understand how the 401k would work, and so they'll fight it just because they don't get it. So let's spend a little time, and maybe we can... get that in focus for people. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be right back.
Jerry Brown's lover, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's double funny then. Forgot. Yeah. little Lyndon Ronstadt for you.
Like minds, you know, they cling together.
You and Bob. Yeah.
So I remember when she got kicked out of the casino down there for blurting out some radical environmental wacko stuff.
Lyndon Ronstadt?
Oh, yeah. Casino owner came and told her to get off stage and get out of his casino and don't ever come back. Escorted her to the door.
Huh.
What a guy.
Do you have any tape of that, Bob? No, never mind. Just kidding.
Yeah, I think that was more anti-war.
Was that anti-war?
Environmentalism, I recall. It was...
How easily...
Caesar's Palace?
Is this one of those? Look, something...
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah.
Lawrence, forgive them. It's like something shiny went by the window.
Oh, sorry, yeah. Yellow bird.
Yellow bird. Oh, my gosh. So you're listening to We the People Radio, if you haven't figured that out already. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We're here with Lawrence McQuillan talking about public pensions and the crisis, actually, that is public pensions. So what do you think, Lawrence, like the comparison between what they have now with defined benefit and they know exactly what they're going to get when they retire at a certain age, but if they did the 401k plan, what does that sort of look like down the road for somebody?
Well, it's very interesting because the old defined benefit plans made a lot of sense when people worked for the same employer for like 20, 30, 40 years under the old hire and retire model.
Mm-hmm.
My dad, for example, I mean, he worked for the same company for over 40 years. But today, most people don't want to do that. So it turns out that most people actually will come out better under a defined contribution or the 401k plan because they move around a lot more. People just don't want to work for the same company anymore for 20, 30 years. People like their mobility. They like to be flexible. So it turns out that when you run the numbers, and many economists have done this, that for the majority of workers, they actually come out better under a 401k with, under the, you know, the modern workforce than the old traditional plan. So I think, a transition would be easier to sell, to younger people because I think they understand it. They get it. You just need to show them the numbers and how it works.
Well, you're at the mercy of the market there and you know the risk. You're not worried about the government coming in and blowing it and taking all your money. I mean, I think that's a big concern for young folks today, too, is they don't want the government interfering, the ones that have jobs, that is.
Right. Yeah, and as we mentioned with Detroit, I mean, you're not guaranteed anything anymore. I mean, now we've had two federal court bankruptcy decisions essentially saying the same thing, which is in bankruptcy, the cities and counties can reduce pension checks. So these aren't guaranteed anymore. And so I think, but if you kept the money, if you had a 401k, I mean, it's your money. It's yours to keep. And I think the wise thing to do would be to take the long view, invest it, you know, cautiously, prudently in high-grade corporate bonds or municipal bonds. Your rate of return's not going to be great, but then again, you're not, you know, investing in real estate in Taiwan or something either. I mean, you don't want to be risky with this money because it's meant to be there when you retire. So you want to take, you know, the long-term approach and gradually grow it, compounded interest, long-term. And I think that's the smart way to invest it. The pension plans actually have not invested the money smart. I mean, they've gone full force into real estate. Some of the pension plans in California are making loans overseas, direct loans to companies overseas that can't even get a bank loan. I mean, that's how risky they are, is they can't get a traditional bank loan, but CalPERS and CalSTRS will give them money. They've acted so irresponsibly with the pension plan money because they know the taxpayers will always be there to bail them out if they need it.
Yeah, they can always squeeze just a little more blood out of the turnips.
Right.
And, the other thing that your plan would fix is that multiple pension situation. You know, the person who's a fireman for whatever they are, I forget what their cutoff is, but say they do that at the age of 20, retire at 50, and then they become something else that has a pension. So a lot
right.
of these folks have multiple draws on the system, and I'm sure that isn't helping either.
Yeah, double dipping, I think it's called. And there's also pension spiking where usually
that's
final year of compensation is used to determine your pension. And so what they do is they factor in, you know, unused sick days, unused vacation days. And oftentimes government employees, former government employees in California are making more in retirement than they did when they were working.
Yeah, and that's super cost efficient. We can really plan for that.
Oh, but they owe it to them. They worked hard. Come on.
Well, it's tough because this does create, you know, some value judgments. People get, you know, they don't want to be haters of our public folks. I mean, we all need firemen. We all need the police. And then it becomes a you don't like law enforcement or you don't like whatever. And how have you seen this dialogue go? Because I know here locally it turned into a brawl at one point, and it was all personal.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, you know, the public employees try to paint it as a direct attack on them. But I think that's why it's important to have a generous alternative. I mean, what I'm proposing in the book, a 10% 401k, is still way beyond anything almost anybody would have access to in the private sector. So it would be replacing a, you know, extremely generous defined benefit plan with a very generous 401k plan. It's just that this way you can get the costs under control. And there's also this moral element to it. I think it's, you know, highly immoral to push this debt onto our kids and grandkids, which is what's going to happen if we don't step up and solve this problem today. This is going to get pushed on to our kids and grandkids who had absolutely nothing to do with accumulating this debt, and yet they're going to get stuck with this bill if we don't fix it today.
That's exactly it, because it is coming like a freight train in places that have had to cut back on their police and fire, as you pointed out. I mean, their cities,
right.
Their cities just
turned
into...
Yeah, for example, in Oakland, they reduced their police force by 80 officers.
Oops.
Because they needed that money to pay for the pension costs. And immediately after reducing their police staff by 80 officers, Oakland Police Department announced that they were no longer going to respond to 44 different crimes. I think that's highly immoral when you're changing, you know, public safety for pension costs. I mean, I think that's the tipping point. And I think that's the tipping point for most Californians. I mean, I think we're there. I mean, I think that's why most Californians, as I mentioned, 85% of likely voters see pension costs as a big problem. And it's because people are seeing these sacrifices of core essential public services like police and fire in the name of pension costs. And I think that, you know, we've gotten to the point now where this is no longer sustainable. We need to make some sort of radical change, and but yet, you know, not harm public employees, because we'll make good on the promises that were made in the past for the benefits already earned, and we're going to replace it with still a very generous 401k. It's just that the current plan can't go on any longer. It's unsustainable, both financially and morally.
And in your plan, the 401k would take over for people who are just brand new or people who are currently working? Does it replace everybody?
Well, I would like to see it applied to both current workers and new hires.
Sure.
Because that's where you get the significant savings that you need to pay off this debt. As I mentioned, you know, with the blimp example, if you just go with new hires, you're not really going to make significant enough savings, and the savings are going to happen, you know, 20, 30 years down the road. To really get a handle on this problem and to do it and to solve it without further tax increases and further service cuts, I think you need to kind of consider doing this across the board. No sacred cows, everybody's in, everybody would be impacted. But again, it would still be a very generous alternative, and an alternative that almost nobody in the private sector would have available for them, which is a 10% 401k.
Because you were saying private sector's 2 or 3%?
Yeah, 2 to 4% on average. Although even that, I mean, 55% of all workers in the private sector have no employment-based retirement plan whatsoever. So, but of the ones that do, they tend to be, you know, the 401k, but only a 2 to 4% contribution. And here I'm proposing a 10% contribution. Even at that extreme pension benefit, you still save more than $6 billion a year at the state level in California that you can then use to pay off the accumulated debt.
Now, if they're public employees, is this an optional thing? You know, is this the 401k? What if they decide they don't want one? Are they allowed to just not fund a retirement plan at all?
Well, the 10% would come from the employer. So there would be no requirement for the employee to kick in anything, although in some parts of the country and some parts of the state, I mean, you know, employees can add to it. They can make their own contribution if they want, but there would be no requirement. This would be a pension benefit provided by the employer to the employee.
I know in a lot of private practice, they have 401ks that have matching funds. They'll match a certain percentage of what you kick in. If you don't kick in anything, they don't kick in anything. And I think, really, that's not a bad idea. I mean, you have to show an interest in your own future security, or why should anybody else? And I think it's the same thing with the state and, you know, local governments. If people don't put forth an effort to secure their future, where is it written that that the public is responsible for that?
Their parents.
Yeah, I mean, I actually agree with you, but what I did is I took, you know, the most generous 401k plan in the public sector. You know, as I mentioned, Michigan and Alaska, you know, both long ago moved in this direction. So that's how I came up with the 10%. I just took the most generous plan out there that's already being provided without any kind of match. But you're right, some parts of the country require, you know, a certain, like, to get the full contribution from the government employer, you have to match or at least put in, you know, a certain bare bones, like 2 to 3%, something like that. I have no problem with that. I think you're right. I think you should take responsibility, at least a minimal amount, for your own retirement.
Sure.
And have to put in something. But, you know, I provided the most optimistic scenario using current benefits that are provided around the country for 401ks for public sector employees. And even with that most optimistic scenario, you still get huge savings of $6 billion a year at the state level.
Wow. Well, that would solve a lot of problems. We need to take one last break. We are here with Lawrence McQuillan. And just in case you were thinking he was just some guy that had extra time on his hands and decided to write a book, he actually earned his PhD in economics from George Mason University and served in positions at the Hoover Institute, the Illinois Policy Institute, and Pacific Research Institute. So Lawrence actually does know what he's talking about, even though he has an easy answer, you know? It seems like it's always complicated here, but today's kind of an easy day. We'll be right back with you. You're listening to We the People Radio. You can join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Okay, we need that decoded. What the heck was that? The Jerry Brown song?
This is one of the legendary West Coast punk rock songs of the late 70s, California Uber Alice by the Dead Kennedys.
And, you know, of course, Jerry Brown was in office then again, so we could...
I think we could cross it over to adult contemporary now in 2015.
Yeah, probably.
Elevator
probably.
Music.
It'll be music pretty quick. Oh, my gosh. Bob, you're killing us today. So, Mr. McQuillan, in our last, like, 5 minutes, what's the thing, you know, what's the stuff you'd really like people to know? Because most people are not looking at this, or they're just angry, and they're not willing to discuss it. They're either angry because you're talking about their pension, or they're angry because you're talking about their tax dollars. How do you get them all?
Well, I'd like to leave on an optimistic note.
There you go.
2 weeks ago, a ballot initiative was filed by the former mayor of San Jose, Chuck Reed, a Democrat, who filed a ballot initiative to reform California's pension plan. This would be on the ballot in November of 2016, so there's a ways to go here. It needs to gather signatures to get it on the ballot yet. So it's still in the early stages. But what the ballot initiative would do, two things. One, it would require an approval by the voters for any pension benefit increases in the future. So if politicians want to increase pension benefits, which they've done in the past irresponsibly, in my opinion, the voters would have to approve that, which is, I think, is a very good step, since they're going to be stuck with the bill ultimately for this. So they might as well have the final say on any kind of pension benefit increase. So that would be one provision. And then the other one would be that as of a certain date, they pick January 1st, 2019, any new hire at the state and local level in California, government employee, any new government employee hire after that date would be enrolled into a 401k plan rather than the old defined benefit plan. So that would be the default going forward, would be the 401k plan. So it's a good first step. I think if it makes it to the ballot, I think, as I mentioned, I think the polling numbers show that the public realizes this is a significant problem that's gotten out of hand, and I think it would have an excellent chance of being approved at the ballot in 2016.
That's kind of great. And so who's really, you know, who's going to resist this? I'm guessing unions, but I could be wrong.
Right. No, you guessed right. It will be the public sector employee unions will oppose it very strongly. You know, expect a lot of misinformation and painting this as an attack on them. But again, I think it's important to have an alternative out there saying that, you know, we're proposing a very generous alternative here in my book. And I think that, you know, this is not about harming the public sector employees. It's about creating a sustainable path forward, which is, you know, competitive pension benefits and a way to create the savings that's required to pay off this huge accumulated debt. Unless we walk away from this debt, which I think would also be immoral, is to walk away what people have already earned. Well, that we have to come up with a way to fund it, and this is a way of doing it: is transition out of the old plan into the modern pension plans that businesses have chosen, you know, decades ago to move towards.
Well, I think that's what Scott Walker, you know, did or attempted to do in Wisconsin was get that public union under control, and I mean they made some great strides there, and they survived, and I mean the state didn't collapse, and so I mean it can be done.
Yeah, it can. In fact, for example, San Diego passed something similar at the city level, where new hires are put into a 401k, and you know the police union said, "Oh, we're going to have a hard time recruiting new police officers if we do this," and they ended up having the largest recruitment class ever in the history of the city of San Diego. So I think it's a myth that this will destroy the public sector employees in California. And in fact, I think it's going to create, you know, the savings we need to fund other programs like libraries and teachers and core essential services like firefighters.
Yeah, we used to have parks programs when we were kids and all sorts of things. And, yeah, you're right. We've cut a lot of that. Our time is up, but we are really thankful that you joined us here on Father's Day, actually. Thank you very much. We've had Lawrence.
Hey, it was great to be with you.
Thanks a lot. And his book is California Dreaming. The author is Lawrence McQuillan. We've got links on our website. It's Lessons on How to Resolve America's Public Pension Crisis. Hey, welcome back. We the People Radio here. Bill's playing air drums. It ain't pretty. You got air drums made for radio, bud.
Hey, I didn't go with air guitar and make the face. Come on.
There was a face involved.
I was going to do the Dana Carvey face, you know.
He does the best guitar face.
Oh, yeah.
So you're joining Aaron Ryan, Bill Cundiff, Bob Martin here at We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. And this hour, we need to give Mr. Stewart a call. We are revisiting our good friend, Mr. Leighton Stewart. If you have not heard this guy before, you're blowing it.
Yeah, he's
he is hilarious. I love him.
Talking about something very uncomfortable, global warming.
Yes. He's kind of a climate denier.
Got to roll your sleeves up for this one.
He's funny. Actually, of note, he was in that, and I had forgotten this, but he was in the movie Blue.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
I totally forgot about that. And you know what? I'm off my game. We had a death in the family, so I know that's no excuse, but I've been kind of a bonehead about the website here. I need to add that because was I ahead of myself? Did I do it? No, I didn't do it. Knucklehead.
Blue Beats Green is the movie, and he's in the trailer. I'll add the trailer to the page.
Yeah. I was reading.
Awesome.
Yeah, he is. I was reading an article a couple days ago about the whole green, the green energy failing throughout the world, and a lot of countries are kind of pulling back a little bit. Australia recently pulled their funding from the UN on some green energy program. It was in the millions of dollars. Right on the heels of our illustrious president going over there and trying to rip him for not supporting the global warming, UN global warming initiatives. In response, he said, basically, you don't know what you're talking about, and we're pulling our funding from the UN. And Britain now is looking at doing the same thing. It's breaking them. They're just not going to throw any more money at this because it's breaking the bank.
Because it's stupid.
It is stupid. And the U.S., I mean, the agreement we just signed with China, basically says we have to reduce ours by like 25% by 2030. They can continue to increase their CO2 emissions until that time. And then in 2030, they have to level off. Well, we all know that China right now is probably one of the biggest polluters out there, and they're gonna be allowed to increase their production of CO2 until that time while we're cutting back. So really, I mean, are we gonna clean the air up all by ourselves here?
Well, and why would we?
Yeah, it's just the whole premise doesn't hold water to start with, but to level all these taxes and energy BS that they're laying on us.
Why did you say it like that?
BS. Because I'm starting, my blood pressure's going up. I'm
BS,
sorry.
It's really quiet.
I know. BS.
I swear, BS.
Can I?
Bovine excrement.
That's right. That's right. So we're going to have Leighton Stewart on.
Is he
here with us?
Yeah,
he's going to help us out with this. He's going to bring me off the ledge, and we're going to talk about. Global warming.
We're going to talk about how plants need
climate change.
Plants, I refuse to say that. Plants need CO2. I love that. That's his website, plantsneedco2.org. Also, therightclimatestuff.com. He's got a bunch of different things out there. And I just added the Blue Beats Green trailer because that is a great movie. And you can see our guest in action there in the trailer. So, Mr. Stewart, how have you been since the last time we talked to you?
Well, I'm just kicking right along. Hope you folks are doing well.
Well, you know what? We have been, I've been just using the heck out of your mouth-to-mouth resuscitation CO2 poisonous gas deal there. And you know what? That is a showstopper. That just cuts them right off at the knees. It's awesome.
That's correct. I'm telling you, there's not a single example of carbon dioxide being a pollutant. They cannot come up with one. They never have been able to come up with it. And you guys were talking about China there. China is clearly the number one, emitter of carbon dioxide. So I just wanted to throw that in.
Oh, and it's going to
be right on track on that one.
Yeah, yeah.
Bill gets another high five. So, hey, for the folks who haven't heard you before, because now we're also airing in Philadelphia, so they are our new friends across the country. They may not take the time to go back and listen to old shows. So give them that mouth-to-mouth resuscitation example so they, too, can cut people off at the knees.
Well, I tell you what. When you look at everything that carbon dioxide does, you've got two big impacts. One is on the plant and animal kingdom, and the other one is a small impact that is on Earth's climate. And all you have to do that is do what old Winston Churchill said. He said, the farther backward you look, the farther forward you're likely to see. And I love that comment because I'm a geologist by background. That's the way we were taught to study the Earth and see what has happened in Earth's past to be able to understand why it's like it is today, why the earthquakes are where they are, you know, where we should expect volcanic activity and all of that kind of stuff. And all that works real well. And all that really helps you kind of look forward and say, well, what's likely to happen, you know, in the next year, the next millennia on Earth, because this is what has happened over and over again in the past. That gets back to climate science here, because nothing is happening now that's different than it has been in the past. That's what all the global statistics show. despite what they say. They say, oh, we're having more extreme weather events. The international statistics do not, and I emphasize, do not bear that out. Somebody just said that, and they all picked up on it, and they've run with it, and they're making everybody think that every storm, every drought we have, da-da-da-da-da, is something really unusual. Well, California is having a problem with droughts. There's no question about that. But if you look back at about the year, let's say 800 A.D., when the Mayans all of a sudden disintegrated in mid-America down there, that drought lasted over 100 years.
Oh,
and it
lovely.
Totally changed the civilization. Now, I'm not wishing that on California.
Well, obviously, they weren't.
But just
ahead
to
of the...
put it in perspective,
sure.
Earth is, I mean, we're not seeing anything today that is different or unusual from what has happened in Earth's past.
Well, they should have stayed on top of their CO2 emissions back then, and maybe that wouldn't have happened. And, you know, we all know that they were spot on with the whole December 21st, 2012 prediction. So, I don't know.
Oh, weren't they?
Yeah,
hashtag buy an epic fail.
I know it. This would all be laughable if it wasn't so serious.
Oh, it's just so irritating. I mean, you know, and to top it off, the only good thing about Earth Day this year is that the VA will be on the hot seat. So Earth Day just bugs the.
You know, I learned something about Earth Day.
Let's talk about the folks that are, you know, get excited on Earth Day. I mean,
I have a
strong environmental background myself, and actually, I started out on the other side of this. CO2's causing climate change issue, and started to write a book about that when I heard that the CO2 levels on Earth used to be 7,000 parts per million about 500 years ago, and then 5,000 parts per million, and then even as much as a couple of thousand parts per million as recently as the Cretaceous 100 million years ago, et cetera. And I thought, boy, it must have had a humongous.
Well, everything died.
And then
didn't everything die when it was that high? I mean, the plants and everything must have just croaked.
No. Nothing died. That's when a whole lot of things came into being. In fact, I put a chart together to show what had happened when Earth's plants showed up. The paleontologists have dug all of these things, of course, out of our rocks and sediments and everything. The first land plants on Earth came in about 430 million years ago. Well, the CO2 level was over 4,000 parts per million then. That helped the plants probably come in because, as you recall, we all learned in the third grade that CO2 is what plants eat. Well, the more that you put in the atmosphere, the more they have to eat and the better they grow. So when you look at that chart, you see that we've come from 7,000, 4,000, 2,000 parts per million down to what we're breathing today, which is only 400 parts per million today. And nearly all of our plants evolved on Earth when CO2 levels were way higher than they are today. And I think that may be one reason that they're responding so well to the additional CO2 that we are putting in the atmosphere now since the Industrial Revolution. It's something that the world's agricultural community, because of them being commercially involved and a lot of the plants, trees, and food crops and things like that, they have done nearly 3,000 peer-reviewed studies. I emphasize peer-reviewed studies that show what happens when we give the plants, food crops, and trees more carbon dioxide. And to just summarize the essence of it in kind of one sentence here, the 8 most consumed food crops on Earth, if we let CO2 levels build up, say, another 300 parts per million, only 300 parts per million, would increase their growth by 39%.
Wow.
that's what these experiments have shown. I'm not talking about model experiments. I'm talking about real experiments of having these chambers where they add carbon dioxide in.
Well, we have that video. We've brought it forward from a previous program that we did with you, the video that says seeing is believing. The one about the one with the little seedling, and they go from 450 parts per million, which is that's what's normal for us, right? Don't we live in about 400 and something parts
Correct.
Per million?
Correct. That's not a whole lot more.
But I don't know if you'd call that normal, though. I mean,
but I mean that's like regular if we're just walking around.
Yeah, today.
Well, the CO2 level at the time of the Industrial Revolution was 280 parts per million.
Wow.
And it's risen to 400 parts per million in 150 years. Now, during that 150 years, Earth has warmed. There's no question in my mind that Earth has warmed somewhat. Not a whole lot, but it has warmed. And that's what got everybody excited, particularly when this got so popular in the 80s and early 90s, because the CO2 level was going up steeply, which it still is, and the Earth's temperature was going up at a fairly, you know, reasonable high pace. But when we look back, we see that the rate of Earth's temperature increase was just as high from 1910 to the 1940s. And, you know, why did the temperature go up just as fast then as it has more recently in the 80s and 90s, if CO2 was what driving it? Let me add one more observation there. Earth has not just been warming recently since the Industrial Revolution. Earth has been warming since the year about 1715. That is 300 years ago. So I like to ask the people that I call the warmest alarmist, why did Earth warm for the first 150 years when carbon dioxide was not going up at all?
Yeah, what caused it back then?
Yeah, what caused that first 150 years of warming?
Yeah, 'cause that's a long time.
And they just give you a big blank look. They've got no answer for
that. We should make a movie about that. We could call it It's an Inconvenient
Truth.
Well,
it'd sure be better than the one that's out now called The Merchants of Doubt. I just saw that.
Oh.
That Naomi Oreskes put together, and she kept saying that the skeptics, which I guess I'll have to say that I've moved to the skeptic side of this, and she says that the skeptics are ignoring the science, yet in the entire movie, she did not give any science examples that, you know, something real, something empirical, is causing Earth to warm. All they have are these unvalidated climate models, and the modelers have no incentive to try to come in and prove, well, hey, it's not CO2, it's just Mother Nature and all of her 22 other natural factors that are driving the climate, da-da-da-da-da. So it's a real pity the way this thing's going. What's happening, obviously, is that the media has picked up on these catastrophic model forecasts because they know we humans are suckers for catastrophes that are either unfolding today or might unfold tomorrow or next year or 10 years from now.
Leighton, we're gonna take a quick break here, but when we come back, I would like you to talk about what are truly the biggest factors and what are the biggest contributors to CO2 in our environment today. So with that,
okay.
With that, we'll be here breathing in and out.
Yeah, I'll try to limit my breathing.
Way to go.
Join us online at wethepeopleradio.us.
I'm going to take a deep breath and hold my breath.
Don't pant.
We'll be right back.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my
You're listening to We the People on AM 1460 KCNR.
I am the God of Hellfire. CO2 alert.
There's fire.
Danger, Will Robinson.
If we could have found a song that was called Forest Fire, that would have been awesome. Hey, you're listening to We the People Radio. We are being joined by Leighton Stewart. He's a geologist, environmentalist, author, and retired energy industry executive. And he's also just our super favorite fun guest on this whole thing about climate science.
Yes, absolutely.
Because it's just funnier when he says it. I don't know why.
Hey, Leighton, tell me, what are the biggest contributors to CO2 in our environment, and is it something we can just, like, control?
Well, as far as the contributors of carbon dioxide, it's humans. Because what we're doing is we're taking these fossil fuels that are in the ground and putting that carbon dioxide, when we burn them, we're putting that carbon dioxide back into the atmosphere from where it came. All of these source rocks, source shales, things like that, that took carbon dioxide out of the air as those plants and even the sea life that's in the oceans, et cetera, took it out of the atmosphere or out of the oceans and built their bodies with it, et cetera, and that all settled to the bottom and ultimately stacked up and stacked up and stacked up and finally turned into rocks, and some of it we see in the cliffs as we drive along the highway in the outcrops. Anyway, that is now getting put back in the atmosphere as we burn some of these products. So there's no questions that since the Industrial Revolution, which, like I said before, was 280 parts per million in the atmosphere, to build it up to today's 400 parts per million, that is mostly human caused.
Well, how much?
The result has been spectacular in what it has done for the Earth. Earth is getting greener and greener and greener, and satellites are proving that because the plants, the trees, are growing like crazy despite all of the bad stuff we're doing, such as paving everything in sight with asphalt, concrete, putting buildings everywhere, and even clear-cutting some of the rainforest. Earth, net-net, as proven by the satellite, is getting greener. The true environmentalists are on the wrong side of this issue and do not even know it. I finally had to recognize when I started out on the other side, I said, hey, Leighton, you're on the wrong side of this thing. Carbon dioxide, net-net, is very beneficial to life on Earth.
And how much of an impact, we all see the satellite images of forest fires and volcanoes and all this, where they just blanket the atmosphere with smoke. How big of an impact, as compared to humans, does that take into account?
Well, it does have some impact, but you've got to be careful about some of the stuff we're putting in the atmosphere, because a lot of it puts things called aerosols, little bitty particles, in the atmosphere, and net-net aerosols actually cool the Earth because they give you some kind of, it's like having a smaller amount of cloud up there.
Is that human caused or is that natural?
No, some of that would be human caused. Obviously, the forest fires are mostly natural. They're mostly caused by lightning strikes, which, again, is Mother Nature. But that's been going on forever.
And anyway, what about volcanoes?
Volcanoes put aerosols in the atmosphere and cool the Earth, clearly cool the Earth. Mount Pinatubo back in 92, I believe it was, clearly caused a cooling of the Earth. As you look farther back at some of the big ones like Krakatoa and so forth, it cooled the Earth for a couple of years. It put so many particles in the atmosphere, and the water vapor in the atmosphere nucleated around these little particles, caused it to get a lot cloudier. When these low-level clouds are there, the sun shines down on the top of those clouds, which, by the way, are very white on top and a lot of times dark on the bottom. But it just reflects the sun's energy back into space, and Earth doesn't really warm. All you have to do is walk outside without a hat, sun shining on you. It's hotter than blue blazes. Cloud comes over, and it gets very comfortable.
So
it's
if we
because
had,
that heat is reflected back
right.
into space.
So if we had a big volcano, would that kind of put the whole global warming thing kind of on its heels for a while?
It would, but it depends on how big it is as to how long that would happen. I mean, if we had one of these huge eruptions, like if Yellowstone Park went off again, like it did 640,000 years ago when it created a big caldera there that's 45 miles long and 30 miles wide.
Right, right.
That that would be a real catastrophe because Earth would really cool for some period of time.
What impact did, say, a volcano eruption the size of Mount St. Helens, on a global scale, that probably wasn't much.
No, it didn't cause much on a global scale.
Okay.
That was mainly the side of the mountain that kind of decided to slide off as more and more pressure built up inside that mountain. And so we didn't get all of that much earth cooling out of Mount St. Helens. It was a relatively small, big eruption, I guess you'd call
yeah.
it.
From a human standpoint, it looked pretty big, but from a global standpoint,
it was not all that big.
A blip
certainly
on the radar,
not.
As they say.
But the main thing I'd like to stress here is in looking at these two impacts of CO2, because so many of our true environmentalists have been so grossly misled on what carbon dioxide is doing to the Earth, I'd like to beg them to look at the real data and see what is happening as we put more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. It is a real help to our ecosystems, habitats, as I said earlier, plants, food crops, forest. All of that has been documented. It is clearly a positive there. And if you're a conservationist, if you're an environmentalist, and look at the real statistics on that and put in the back of your mind that somebody in the administration said CO2 is a pollutant when there is absolutely not a single example. Go ask any college professor, high school professor of chemistry to give you an example. In 8.5 years of giving talks on this, I've never had one rise to that challenge. They cannot come up with a single example. Carbon dioxide is the gas of life. It's just a fact. So these true environmentalists have been so grossly misled that they think that is pollutant going up. I laughed when I saw this movie, Merchants of Doubt. All they showed at the front end and back end was all of this stuff belching out of these, smokestacks and everything. Carbon dioxide is colorless, odorless, and tasteless. You cannot see carbon dioxide. So that is totally misleading that all of that stuff you see coming out of these stacks is CO2. Now, is there some CO2 coming out? Yeah, probably so. If it's something that's being burned in there, whatever's being burned, part of it's probably turned into CO2. But it's certainly not what you see coming out of those stacks.
Wow. It just keeps going, doesn't it?
Oh, yeah.
So
it just
irritating.
It just wears you out.
It but does,
anyway,
too, because they're not getting anywhere.
Tell environmentalists to just remember what they learned in the third grade. CO2 is what plants eat. Tell them there are thousands of peer-reviewed studies they should go look at and find out what CO2 is doing for the plant and animal kingdom.
We will, and I have. Non-nerdy science, they give you all these details, and it's like, I can't go toe-to-toe with them on that. But
let's get back to basics.
But I can deal with, real simple things like your mouth-to-mouth resuscitation example. If you're breathing, 40,000 parts per million? into yes. some, and it was a pollutant, you would have killed them every time, and we didn't.
No, that's right. No, there are several really good examples on that, and you're mentioning a good one. If somebody, you know, had a heart attack and you were going to give them mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, you would be breathing out of your lungs and into theirs to save their life, what you said, 40,000 parts per million. We're only breathing 400. The government statistics show CO2 is not a pollutant. In our nuclear submarines, where the submariners stay underwater for, you know, 3 or 4 months at a time, they allow the CO2 level to build up to 8,000 parts per million, 8,000 in those submarines before they decide they need to kick in a little more oxygen. Da 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 da. NASA, when NASA sends somebody to Mars and back, they think that's probably about a 3-mile round trip. They're going to let those capsules contain 5,000 parts per million.
And here well, that's a good one.
Breathing 400, and they're acting like, oh my gosh, if it goes to 450 or 500, it's just going to pollute us all.
So bottom line is, if we put astronauts in the capsule with 5,000 parts per million, bottom line is we would have killed them before they got off the launch pad.
I'll tell you one thing, they better take a lawnmower with them because the boss is going to get
sick
in
it.
There.
Take an Instagram.
The lawnmower, I love it. That's good.
And a weed eater. Oh my gosh. All right, we're going to be right back. We've got to take a quick break. We're talking to Leighton Steward. We always have such a good time with you. You're on We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Be right back. Classic.
That was something Stevie Wonder did back in the late 70s.
Secret Life of Plants, huh?
That was the name of the album.
Huh. Where was that when we needed it earlier?
Oh, my.
So Leighton, we've got a question in the chat room here. Somebody's asking about the idea of solar radiation management or what they're calling...
A.K.A.
Or what they're calling geoengineering. Where are you on that whole thing?
Well, I think we better be real careful when they start tampering with that because, you know, we've had in the last 800,000 years, we've had 8 ice ages and 8 interglacials like we're in right now. We're in an interglacial period that's been going on for at least 10,000 years right now, and we're very fortunate to be there because the glacial periods usually last 85 or 90,000 years, and the interglacials average a little over 10,000 years. Some of them longer, some of them shorter. Let's hope ours is longer because we've been at this about 10,000 years. So to put that in perspective, we don't want to go up and put a lot of stuff in the atmosphere that's going to reflect the sunlight back into space before it ever reaches the Earth and watch Earth all of a sudden start cooling, because when Earth starts cooling, the plants don't grow as well in cold. And boy, we could cut the food supply on Earth overnight and just starve hundreds of millions more people, because we already have probably 1.3 billion people on the edge of starvation right now, that, you know, worldwide, and some of the statistics I've seen. So we've got to be real careful about that geoengineering. Can we do small-scale geoengineering? We might be able to do that. But the bottom line is, I don't think we have to, and let me bring in the cavalry on this. I was invited about 3 years ago to give a talk here in the Hill Country northwest of San Antonio to a bunch of retired NASA scientists and some astronauts, and gave them a lot about what I'm talking to you about. And when it was over with, I found out they were already concerned about what they were hearing coming out of NASA and the administration today. They said, you know, NASA's making some comments like this man-made climate change is really a problem, but they're not showing us any data to back that up. Said, back when we were putting people on the moon, we had a big sign on the wall that said, "In God we trust, all others bring data." And so,
I love that one.
Yeah, so they were really concerned about that. Anyway, after it was over with, they invited me to go to the Space Center in Houston. I gave the same talk to a whole lot more of the NASA alumni. These are people that aren't beholden to the administration anymore. They're retired. So they don't have to worry about what they say. They can say what they see and not worry about repercussions. Anyway, they put together a team, and that team is called The Right Climate Stuff. They've been at it 3 years now, and let me tell you who these people are real quickly. They're chemists, they're physicists, astrophysicists, geophysicists, mathematicians, meteorologists, geologists, etc. A lot of them PhDs. There's 25, maybe as many as 30 of them that are on that team. What they have decided after 3 years, and what's on their website, which is therightclimatestuff.com, are these conclusions. The science of the major cause of climate change is not settled. Natural processes, which would be Mother Nature, dominate climate change. Man-made CO2 impact appears to be muted or very little. Real empirical evidence does not support catastrophic warming in the future. The government is overreacting to concerns about man-made warming. These catastrophic forecasts are coming from these unvalidated climate models. They've looked at that real hard. Those models aren't worth blah. They've never projected anything yet that's been right. The climate models contain assumptions of Earth's sensitivity to CO2 that are far too high. Earth's sensitivity is measured by if we double CO2, how much would it warm the Earth? And all these models have that sensitivity too high, they say, by a factor of about 3. Here's one that had been bugging me. That the EPA and administration call CO2 a pollutant is scientifically embarrassing. And when they go back and just make a simple model based on real temperature and CO2 relationships since the Industrial Revolution 163 or 4 years ago, they say that the maximum rise in temperature projects at only about 1.2 degrees Celsius by the end of this century. That's not going to overheat anything. In fact, it'll make the plants grow a little bit better if the Earth gets a little bit warmer. So this is from a bunch of people that are putting their reputations on the line. They have impeccable reputations. Whether it's 80 years from now, 8,000, 80,000 years from now, this will be the team of scientists that they will look back and say, this is the first group of scientists that put humans on another heavenly body and brought them home. When we sent people to the moon and back. First time man had left Earth.
You're not buying into that, are you?
Well, come back, and they are risking the wrath of all of these people that are saying us, we skeptics, are crazy, blah, 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 blah. They're risking all of that because they say we're off base. CO2 is good. It's not causing any significant climate change. We can see that in the data. It is not.
So how do we, bottom line is, how do we, because it's become, it's, you know, yeah, there are the true believers out there who think, you know, we're all going to die because of CO2. But what's really picked up so much steam is all this idea of cap and trade and all that. It's the economic.
Oh, that's money, money, money.
Yeah, it's just a
follow
big...
Follow the money. It's what the Russian poet Pushkin said maybe a couple hundred years ago, maybe 150, I don't know what it was. The Russian poet Pushkin said, where there is a trough, there will be pigs. And the government, back in the early 90s, started putting out all of this money for people to study not what's causing climate change, but only what man-made carbon dioxide is doing to cause Earth to get warmer. And so we're never... Even if they said, well, CO2 is causing the Earth to get warmer, which it is a little bit, you'd never know, well, how much of the current warming is caused by that versus natural factors if you don't study the natural factors. But you've got a whole bunch of people feeding at that trough. You've got the administration itself, because they'd love to see a cap and trade and see all the tax dollars from all that stuff come across the desk. And President Obama wouldn't be any different than previous presidents. They all like a flow of dollars because they can go figure out some way to buy votes. The green industries selling us green products are making money. The Wall Street brokers would make billions of dollars in carbon credit sales. Academia has been my biggest disappointment, because I know from having been on the board at Tulane and the largest college at SMU that we loved those professors that brought in the big grants. They got promoted faster. They got tenured faster if they brought a lot of money into the universities, because the universities get ranked to a big extent, not the only extent, by how many research dollars they bring in. In other words, there's not a top 25 university in the United States that's not bringing in at least $30 million of grants every year.
Wow.
So you can see, gets back to what Pushkin said, where there's a trough, there will be pigs. And the government and some of these private foundations are giving money to try to see what man is doing with his carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. Then you got the environmental extremists that get their money by scaring it out of your pocket. And lastly, of course, is the media that knows that we will all line up and listen to their station when they say, folks, we've got a catastrophe unfolding, or one may unfold. So I think that's our problem, and it's mainly media-based as far as I'm concerned with the general public, because climate science is very complex. Plant science, and that's one reason I talk about plant science as much as I do, is plant science is a lot easier to understand than complex climate science.
Yeah, true. Yeah, regular people, you're right, we learned that in third grade. We need to take one more quick break, but just something point to ponder. Earth Day just happens to be on Lenin's birthday. I'm sure that was an accident.
Coincidence?
I don't think so. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online at wethepeopleradio.us. Isn't that the truth of it? Hey, welcome back to We the People Radio. We're here with Leighton Steward, who is our favorite climate science guest. Yeah, sure, say that quickly. All right, so in our last, five-ish minutes or so, how are we going to turn this around?
Well, you've got to talk to the folks that are representing you in Washington. That's about the only way we're going to do it. Clearly, our president and the administration that he's leading up there right now, they want to get something in here and say that carbon dioxide's causing all the problem. We've got to stop energy use, et cetera. It's going to have a horrible impact, and it's and the impact it has is going to be worse on the poor people of the country, because as we raise the utility costs, the transportation costs, the cost of food, et cetera, by going to these more expensive, unreliable alternative energies, it's going to cut them off at the knees because they don't have any extra optional dollars to spend on that. And even the previous Pope said that it would clearly, if we got in and tried to reduce carbon dioxide, it would hurt the poor the most. That's about all I know to do. I mean, I've done, 104 of these radio shows since January of last year, so I'm doing what I can and will continue to do it. And by the way, I'm not getting one penny for doing this. I'm working somewhat off and on with this NASA bunch, which I really like because it's a bunch of really bright people. They're not getting paid a penny for what they're doing either. So if you want an objective bunch of first-class scientists, go and look at their website and see what they're coming out with. It's horribly frustrating because the media does not have any incentive to put out the good news about carbon dioxide. They say, well, you know this better than I do. Bad news sells and good news doesn't sell.
So yeah.
I'm afraid it's about that simple. So the only way we're going to turn around what's going on in Washington is to vote folks in there that are going to stop the administration from having the United States use the most expensive energy in the world while we give them our leftover oil, gas, coal, whatever, so they'll rest of the world will have the cheapest energy. Because if we do that, if that's not economic suicide, I don't know what it is.
See, that's the kicker, is that all of this is it's a control mechanism, you know?
It is.
We've got to, in order to help everybody, which is, I think, why Earth Day on Lenin's birthday is so, you know, perfect, and I'm sure that's not a coincidence, but, you know, the whole message is, in order to save the planet, we've got to give up everything and pool our resources and live in a hut, and, you know, and that's how we're going to survive. It's all the politics of scarcity.
Right.
Bob's got two bits for us. What do you got, Bob?
Actually, courtesy of Charles, who called in during the last break, wanted to point out that Earth Day also coincides with Hitler's birthday.
Get out! Really?
Hitler, who had his own environmental agenda, as you may recall.
Whoa. Oh, we said Hitler and we didn't ring the bell. Ding! oh, I guess it's only when we say Nazis. But that's okay. Hitler and Nazis, they're all the same. Hey, thanks, Charles. Okay, so Hitler and Lenin are leading the way on Earth Day. So for all those people that are thinking about, you know, I throw all my recyclables away on Earth Day. I usually litter. It just frustrates me because it's a manipulation.
Well, there are a lot of, I'm really always on the other side of these environmental issues. In fact, I may be the only guy in my industry that ever got an unsolicited Environmental Excellence Award from the Environmental Protection Agency. I was chairman of the National Wetlands Coalition for about 10 years, and also the company I was running spent a lot of volunteer efforts in trying to save the wetlands of the lower Mississippi River Delta, et cetera. So I've really been an environmentalist all my life, but in this case, we were wrong to condemn carbon dioxide. Remember that. Tell people when they come and make some ridiculous statement to you, said, go look at the data. Look at it. Don't just give me a bunch of cliches that somebody stuck in one of their op-ed columns or something. Da-da-da-da-da. And anyway, as people say, the truth will out. Unfortunately, it may be two or three more decades of the Earth not getting warm before some of these people turn around. I don't know, but all we can do is try. And
exactly.
It's people like you that let some of us get on the air and put some facts out in front of people and hope that they say, well, you know, I guess I never really looked at the data. to see what it's really showing. So
yeah,
keep it up, folks.
I don't think they think about it. You know, sometimes I think out of sight, out of mind, in a way. Well, got like a half a minute left, but thank you so much for coming on with us. And if you get any new projects or, I don't know, you come up with any other snappy things, I like the astronaut deal. What is it? What's the parts per million? 5,000 in the capsule?
Excuse me. The astronaut deal on the way to Mars and back is 5,000 parts per million for 3 years.
They better brush their teeth because, man, they're going to have some. They're going to have some green growing on their teeth.
And they're calling CO2 a pollutant.
Yeah, that's great. You know, I can up my game. I can go back to the original people and frustrate them further.
They can raise some big corn crops on that on that spaceship on the way.
It's one way. We'll never know if it worked. Thank you so much. Have a great...
thank you, folks. I appreciate it.
Have a great weekend. You've been listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll have all that info on the VA hearing for you. And have a great week. Bob?
You're listening to KCNR Shasta Redding.